All right, folks. Do You Know Jack Radio Show coming at you from the shores of the Great Slave Lake right here in scenic, sunny Yellowknife Northwest Territories to talk to legendary Canadian rocker Lee Aaron. Lee, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, actually, and it's a pleasure to be able to talk to you finally. Yeah. I had no idea I was calling Yellowknife.
Well, now you know what the 867 area code is. It's, you know, it's the north.
I'm becoming an area code expert, actually, with all these interviews I've been doing lately. But yeah, Yellowknife is the first, but yes, indeed, a pleasure. Here I am.
Well, there you go. And you know, actually, speaking of first, though, I mean, this is the first record that you've put out in quite some time. And I know there's a story there. I mean, you're raising a family.
Well, yeah, you know, and I know a lot of these rocker ladies like, you know, Doro and Joan Jett have like sort of forged forward in their life and have made a commitment to remain childless to eternity, you know, so that they can just keep pumping out records for their fans. And you know what? And that's a totally valid choice. But I have to say, when I met my husband in around 2000, I had been like a full bore career lady. I had made, you know, back-to-back records, and I had toured, you know, three quarters of the way around the world and continued to tour. And he said something really interesting to me when we were dating. He said, gee, you know, what are you going to do? Like, you know, when you're on your deathbed, you're going to like hold all your gold records close and be happy. Or do you want like family around you? And I really felt convicted by that statement, and I thought, gosh, wow. that really weighed heavily on me. And I did a lot of thinking and a lot of reflecting and thought, you know, having a family was something I always kind of thought I would do. Like, it just sort of seemed like a natural thing that I would do someday, but I kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off because I was sort of on this hamster wheel of, you know, write, record, put out an album, tour, write, record, put out an album, do promo, tour. And, you know, that was obviously very artistically gratifying. But, you know, on a personal level, you know, I'd had a few good and bad failed relationships and went, okay, if I really do examine this, you know, my personal life has suffered. So, you know, I made a decision at that point that I would get married. And we tried for a little while to have children unsuccessfully, but then finally in 2004, my daughter Angela was born. She was a miracle baby. And then in 2006, my son was born. And so, yeah. And then that, of course, was a huge, quite significant life interruption. It's called motherhood.
Yes.
So, and you know, it's unbelievable because like, I'm a really sort of somewhat prolific up to that point, you know, creative person. And man, your creative energy just gets sucked out of you like a black hole when you have children. Like, I mean, God love them. I just love my kids to death.
Yeah.
But boy, it sure takes a lot of creative energy to raise them when they're, especially when they're really little. It's quite intense. And
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I've loved every minute of it, but it was time to make a record again. I was really missing that creative process. So.
Oh, I was going to say, your husband's a drummer, too.
Yeah, he is. That's how we met, actually. We met on this crazy cross-Canada tour that I did with a couple of other jazz artists in 2001, actually. And the funny thing is, by the end of the tour, we were like out in Cape Breton, somewhere in the remote area out there, and we had played this church venue, and it was the most gorgeous venue. And I remember him saying to me that night, he said, I just knew that night. He said, you know, I knew I was just going to marry you. And I'm like, I had no clue.
Wow.
And I wasn't so sure. But lo and behold, here we are, like this many years later, and have our family, and life is good. Yeah.
Well, one thing that I found really cool about this record now is your single, Tomboy, you went on and you made a video that featured your daughter and her friends in it. And of course, you know, your husband plays drums on Fire and Gasoline. So in some respects, you know, you've kept things all in the family. You know, your bass player, Dave, he's been playing with you for almost a decade, right? I mean, like, this is a bit of a family affair, is it not?
Well, you've done your research, eh? So, Yeah, well, Dave has been in the band, yeah, for almost a decade. I love Dave Reimer. He's such a great player, and he's like my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And John, of course, is playing on the whole album.
Yes.
And when it came time to make the video for Tomboy, you know, I had a little bit of a logistical issue because part of my band is in Toronto, and we're out in BC, and, you know, and everyone's sort of operating on more of a limited budget these days. The huge record budgets of the yesteryear just don't exist anymore. And so we were looking at how we would do this, and it just occurred to me one day. I was out walking the dogs, and I was like, man, I should just put together a band of tomboys because that just logically makes sense. And, yeah, my daughter, of course, was the first. The song was written for her. And, you know, it's the whole song is supposed to be somewhat of an anthem for young girls and, you know, anyone who has ever felt judged or forced to conform to a stereotype or an expectation that wasn't comfortable for them. And that's what the song is all about. And so her and a few of her little girlfriends, they all go to a fine arts school together, and they just seemed like the logical choice. And the girls were amazing. The song really resonated with them, so they all learned it, you know, overnight. They came to the rehearsal the next day, and we tossed some instruments in their hands and said, nice. Okay, you know, this is how you fake it.
Yeah.
This is how you play in time, and like you're playing air guitar, and they totally rose to the occasion. In fact, the little girl that impressed me the most was the one on drums. She picked it up in about 10 minutes. I'm like, okay, you play the kick on this beat, and you play the snare on that beat, and hit a few cymbals, and, you know, within, like, a half an hour, she was actually almost playing along to the song. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, well, you kind of, you know, talking about art school, I mean, you kind of answered a question that I was going to ask there about you guys both, you know, being musicians and, you know, how you go about, you know, raising up kids in the arts. I mean, I would imagine that just having kids, you know, heavily involved in music and art would be pretty high on your list of things that you'd like your kids to be a part of.
Well, my husband and I have a bit of a different philosophy about that, and that is that I'm not a taskmaster mother. I'm not the type of mother who's, or a stage mother. Like, we've given our kids opportunities to do things like audition for commercials or whatever. They're not really that interested because of, I think, and I'm not the type of mom who's going to push my kids.
Yeah.
But we have two pianos in our home. We've got a multitude of guitars. We've got about 20 drum kits. We have a music library here with about, don't laugh, my husband's a little OCD, it's about 250,000 pieces of vinyl.
Wow.
And about 20 or 30,000 CDs, and the movie collection is the thing that's growing now, the critically acclaimed and classic films. We've got a whole huge addition built onto our house for this. It's so our children are constantly exposed to the arts here.
Yeah.
Just by virtue of the environment that they live in. And they see band guys come and go, and we have rehearsals here because we've got the space. And, you know, they see mom in her project studio downstairs recording demos and working on music. And so are they musical? My daughter is always sitting down at the piano creating, but she's not taken a piano lesson. Not yet. She may decide that she wants to take a piano lessons,
uh-huh,
at some point in time, and she'll let me know. But in the meantime, she's at the piano every day playing because she just hears music all the time. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. And I was a lot like that as a child. I have relatively little formal training. I do have some vocal lessons under my belt, 3 years of piano, a little bit of guitar, but I don't consider myself a virtuoso on anything. But I'm always creating.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always writing. And so I don't really think, I think sometimes music school does more harm than good. Truthfully, I mean, maybe as a music teacher, you're thinking, you know, Lee Aaron's off her rocker, but.
What are you saying, Lee Aaron?
No,
I think that, you know, I actually do have friends that are teachers as well. But, you know, one of our best pals, a guy named Bill Hemme, he's the guitar player from the Pointed Sticks. It's a, uh-huh, legendary Vancouver punk band. He ran the music program at Fraser Academy here in Vancouver for quite a few years. And while he gave all of his students were gifted LD. You know what that is? Gifted learning disabled. And they all found a voice through music. And if they couldn't read music very well, he didn't force that, but he taught them all to play.
Yeah.
And they did a concert at the end of the year that was unbelievable.
Wow.
So I'm much more concerned with my children finding their own voice through an instrument than learning how to play notes that are on a paper.
Well, no, I mean, I think I've felt that way, you know, with our kids as well, because, I mean, my wife is also a musician, and she's, you know, for many years here in Yellen, I've been a violin teacher. Of course, she's not anymore, but, I mean, you know, we want to give our kids opportunities to explore the arts, but, you know, at the same time, as you said, like, it's not something that you really necessarily want to be like, you know, go to the piano right now, you know, get it done.
Well, the thing is, when you trap yourself, you're paying for lessons, expensive lessons for your child. There's this thing as a parent where you're like, okay, you know, I'm spending like $2,000 a year on these lessons. You go get to the piano and you practice now. And that's how your child learns to hate music. If they're forced to do it when it's not a natural inspiration, that's what I feel.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and I mean, even thinking about my own experience when I graduated from music school, it was like I just felt this sense of finality to it. Like I just needed to get away from it for a while. So I did. I went and I worked in a pizza restaurant for a year.
Everybody needs a pizza restaurant experience, don't they?
I think so.
Everyone needs to sling pizza or hamburgers at some point.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, the album Fire and Gasoline now just released March 25th, 2016. And, you know, you were in, you know, heavily involved. Like you produced this record and it's, you know, it's very diverse, which, you know, is kind of something that you've been known for, you know, never really making the same record sort of deal. You know what I'm saying? And there's a lot of impressive people that worked on this record too. Like the fact that you went to, you know, Vancouver's, you know, famed Little Mountain Studios, which apparently is now called The Farm. You know, this studio has a history and there's a reason why you chose that. Am I right?
Well, you know, when I was looking at making this record, I was sort of trying to put some budgets together and things like that. I looked at crowdfunding, but I just thought, icky, everyone's doing it. I just can't beg my fans for money. I'm just going to try to go play a few gigs and save up the money to do this. But it suggested to me, oh, you know, you can just, you know, with digital technology, you know, you can just do some recording out here and then just send the tracks to Toronto and get your guitar player to put tracks on it there. And I'm like, you know, that doesn't really work for me. I'm old school in the way that I was like, no, we need to be all in the same room,
yeah,
laughing and working off each other like a band live off the floor. And then the idea of going into a studio that had some real history to it, where legendary artists had recorded, I just really wanted to capture that whole vibe. Mm-hmm. And so I flew my band out and I'm like, we're going into Little Mountain Sound and we're going to do this there. And so it was just virtue of the fact, you know, you're in this, you know, this place with this huge SSL console and all these gold records hanging on the wall and just the energy in the room was just, it was like, yeah, we're making a world-class record. Let's do it. And, I think that was really significant rather than being trapped in someone's little project studio, even though the technology is there to make world-class sounding records in those type of environments. I wanted to step out and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my band, everybody really appreciated the opportunity to record in a place like that. It made a difference for sure.
Well, and you brought in some pretty world-class engineers with, you know, Ben Kaplan, who, you know, he's worked with Mother and Headley, and then, you know, John Webster, who's got some pretty impressive credits as a vocal engineer. I mean, like, you know, this, you know, I guess there's no small wonder that the record sounds as great as it does because, you know, it's just, you know, you've got all the planets aligned here.
Well, I was very fortunate. I mean, I knew that I wanted to produce the record myself, but a producer can only do their work. It's somewhat reliant on, you know, you need the right guy to dial up, who knows that studio to dial up those sounds for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a great thing when I found out that Ben worked a lot in The Farm and that I was able to get his schedule was available at that time. I jumped at that opportunity to cherry pick Ben. And then, of course, John's done some really impressive engineering work, but he's also a fantastic keyboard player. He played on all those Bon Jovi and all those Aerosmith records and the Tom Cochrane records. And one of my philosophies as a producer is surround yourself with the people you love. and then direct them to do what they do best. You make the final judgment call on what goes on the album, but that, to me, that's the key.
Yeah.
And I just feel really blessed. I was able to work with some great people, and they were they gave great performances, and they all took direction well and gave great feedback as well in terms of contributing to the overall final product. So I was just, I really feel blessed.
You brought in Sean Kelly, who you've known for a few years from the whole Metal on Ice book, and I think there was a recording with that as well, was there not? And that's kind of how you guys, met. You were working on a re-recorded version of Metal Queen, I think.
Yeah, well, and I got to tell you, Sean Kelly is probably one of the only people in the world that could have talked me into re-recording that song. He's such a nice guy, and we got along so well. We met over an interview, a big interview for his Metal on Ice book. Basically, that book, he put together, I think, a very, very important portion of Canadian rock history that had been somewhat neglected in a lot of the Canadian history books. And in fact, that book was inducted into the Canadian Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year, which
was
quite a feather on his cap. And we met over the book. We got along really well. And then he said, I'm thinking of doing a companion CD to go along with the book. And would you be interested in re-recording one of your old hits? I would just like give my left arm if you would redo Metal Queen. And I was like, well, okay. you've talked me into it. So we did that. And we just, again, got along so well. The idea of him came in out and played on a few shows with me. And then it was like, well, it was just like, it's like when you find a musician that just sort of fits in your tribe and fits in your brotherhood, and you just know it's working. And Sean was that person. We're like, well, this is crazy. You just have to join the band now. And he's like, yeah. So he joined, he's in my touring band now. And he is a busy guy, though. Once in a blue moon, he has a project that will pull him away from a tour date. But for the most part, he's on probably 90% of my dates.
Nice.
And and evolved into writing. So he and I wrote co-wrote five songs.
Yes.
On the album as well. Fire and Gasoline, If You Don't Love Me Anymore, Popular, Bittersweet, and I can't think. But there's another one there somewhere that we wrote together, as well.
Now, in an interview with Brave Words' Carl Begay, he says that, she, meaning you, kicked his ass like any producer worth a salt should. Now, like, was your process producing this record, a lot of just working really closely with Sean and experimenting with different sounds and things like that? Like, how did that whole partnership work when you actually got your heads down in the studio?
Well, this is how I work, or how my vision to do this record was. First, we wrote the songs, and the songwriting process, Sean, a couple of tracks, If You Don't Love Me Anymore and Popular, he sent me out somewhat fully formed musical ideas that he had demoed up. I took them into my studio, and I wrote the entire vocal line, melody, and put it together and sent it back. And then a few of the others that we wrote together, he sent me something like Fire and Gasoline was just that opening riff was an iPhone memo that he texted me. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. I took it down into my studio and I re-recorded it as a demo that I programmed up the drums and I actually played all the instruments badly, but I'm not as good a guitar player as Sean, obviously. But but I put together like a rough demo of the track, wrote the vocals, sent it back, and he's like, love it, So that was just came from like a couple of little riffs he sent me. And then I wrote a bunch on my own and I demoed those. And basically I sent the boys in the band the demos of all the songs I wanted to record. It said, learn these. Next weekend we're getting together. So we did, I think we did 2 full days of pre-production in my home studio here where we just tore the songs apart, put them back together. And what I did is I went, okay, Dave, you know, here's my crappy bass line that I played on the demo. You take it and please make it Dave Reimer it, please, because you play way better than I did. So I let everyone do their magic with the parts. But the song chords and the structure was, you know, created by me or me and Sean. You know, and like Popular, for instance, that was a basic drum beat that Sean had programmed up for that song. But Sean took it and it evolved in the course of pre-production where it became this like wild, like Don't Get Fooled Again, like a Who song in with the bottom end. And I'm like, as this was happening, my call as a producer is to go, do I let this go? Do I like this? Or so ideas that I liked, I went with. Ideas that I didn't like, I reined back in and went, no, that's not working. Then we booked, I think we were in the farm. We only went into the studio for 4 days. And we recorded all the bed tracks live off the floor. We were well rehearsed. We recorded everything live off the floor in 2 days. And then I kept Sean for 2 more days, and we did all the guitar overdubs in 2 days. And yes, I pushed him really hard. That's why he's saying I kicked his ass, because I had an agenda. I knew what I wanted to get done. And I knew Sean, of course, did his magic on a few things, which was things that he had already tried out in pre-production. But then there were other very specific parts that even, because one of the things that I do fairly well is I come up with like signature parts when I'm recording a demo where it might be just a guitar line that repeats, you know what I mean? And it's like an overdub. And so there were some very specific things that I wanted recorded on some of the songs. And so I'm like, okay, we'd play the demo and I go, I want that. And let's get that sound. And so it was my modus operandi. I wanted to get all those guitar overdubs done before I flew them back home. And yeah, I think the last night we were there, he was getting bleary eyed. It was like 1 a.m. I'm like, Sean, you've got one more solo on Bittersweet. I'm like, come on, channel your best Lindsay Mitchell, my friend. And he did it, you know, and it was like, yes, we've got it, you know. There's also something that I just love too, but there's with something that I love about having the process be fast and furious. Like we've got a deadline. We've got to get it done. Let's just go for it. Let's have fun with it. When you've got months to monkey around in a studio and you just overthink things way too much, there's not that urgency, I think it just wrecks it. So I'm like, we're going to the studio for 4 days and we're going to slam it out. We're going to get it all done. And we did. And then, I had put like rough vocals on everything, and then I went after and just in a few evenings re-recorded all my vocals with John Webster. He actually is a great vocal engineer, and what I was going for there was just, I'm like, just make me sound as authentically me as you can, because I felt like I'd never really sounded exactly the way I sound when I sing in a room, and he was just you know, a wizard at that. So, and also my process for vocals, I'm not down with punching in a line over and over and over again. I'm like, you know, I'm just going to sing it like 4 times all the way through and then put together a comp, you know, and I'm done.
Yeah.
And then I'll put some background vocals on. So that was kind of the process of Fire and Gasoline.
Considering this was like a 4-day process, I mean, you know, like the record does sound really raw, really organic. I mean, there's so many different elements of your catalog coming out. And I know this has been talked about in other interviews and reviews and whatnot. I mean, I even hear you flex those jazz chops a little bit a couple times. And I mean, there's you know, country rock a little bit in there and, you know, punk rock and straight ahead rock. I mean, you've really made a record that's you know, something for everyone, you know, and definitely kudos to you for that.
Well, thanks. I mean, it wasn't, I think that obviously the overall, it's a straight ahead rock record, you know, and it's the continuity is that it's the same players playing on every song and my same voice on all of the songs. But, you know, my favorite albums growing up were albums that, you know, took you on a musical journey, like those Elton John records or, you know, Fleetwood Mac, or like I've used this example, you know, I apologize a few times, but like, you know, the Rumours album, right? I remember listening to that when I was a teenager. Yeah. And, you know, you've got Christy McVie singing her tender piano ballad, and then you've got Secondhand News, which is like almost like Lindsay Mitchell bluegrass, and then there's The Chain, which is heavy blues rock, and then there's, you know, Dreams, which is a pop song. So there's sort of like a melding of styles, because there's different writers on that record, but they all sound like they belong on the same record, if you know what I mean. But they also, you don't get bored. I think that's what makes that album timeless, is that it's not back-to-back cookie-cutter sounding material. It's every song has its own personality and its own entity, and it gives you something to love about each of those songs, right?
Definitely. Actually, this is a bit of a funny aside, but I remember, you know, there's this friend, this, you know, friend in the business, John Gallagher, who plays in a new wave of British heavy metal band called Raven. And I remember a while ago, he posted about how much he liked Fleetwood Mac's Rumours, which seemed odd for this, you know, guy that's normally doing sort of Iron Maiden sounding heavy metal. But then, I mean, I guess it's such a timeless record that it just resonates with people from all walks of life, doesn't it?
Well, you know, I like Iron Maiden too. I like a lot of, you know, Black Sabbath and Judas Priest growing up, and Zeppelin and Joplin, and I'm just trying to, I mean, I embraced grunge. I loved Soundgarden, and I loved a lot of those bands from that whole grunge period as well. I think that if you, you know, if you're in a heavy metal band and you only listen to heavy metal music, you're doing yourself a disservice. I mean, it doesn't really help you become a well-rounded musician, I don't think. I mean, one of the best things I think I ever did for myself was take a diversion and sing jazz for a while. For me, I felt like it was exploring the history of rock and roll. I mean, this is where it all came from, right? And, you know, where did Zeppelin get their chops in the beginning? And The Who and these bands, you know? Where did the best of the best steal from? Well, they stole from all these old blues guys. And I wanted to dig deeper and find out more about that. And I just, you know, thoroughly loved that whole period in my career, because I felt like it was like a history lesson tenfold, because I actually got to immerse myself in it and embody it and do it. And I feel that it made me a far better, more well-rounded musician and singer and songwriter.
Right on, Lee. Well, listen, you've been very generous with your time here today. And, you know, I just want to thank you, on behalf of myself and the listeners of Do You Know Jack Radio Show for just, you know, hanging in there and, you know, answering, my questions and just, you know, having an all around just great conversation. I really appreciate that.
Those are my favorite kinds. No, it's an absolute pleasure talking to you, Jack.
Right on. Well, you have a good night.
You too. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.